Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Before Me Too and Time's Up became movements, our first guest decided to face a personal demon by dramatizing it for television. That effort is The Tale, HBO's latest original movie starring Laura Dern, and will play for the first time this Saturday night. Writer, producer, and director Jennifer Box joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. One of Animal Planet's most popular programs marks a double milestone Sunday night, finally bid for over its 100th and final episode, and kicks off the network's annual Monster Week. Executive producer Keith Hoffman previews these milestones next half hour. And those civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump will come on after the top of the next hour to advocate Evidence of Innocence, a miniseries running next month on TV One. Also ahead, The Simpsons creator gets a Dog Day debut for Disenchantment, Captain Kangaroo Comeback, our classic trivia question this week, and in our up segment, Georgia Public Academy's next TV undertaking. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York and simulcasting on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, proud development partner of the 2018 New York Television Festival coming this summer, and the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. A good Wednesday afternoon to you and all. Happy to have you aboard for this special 90-day edition of the program All About Television. We have some terrific guests coming your way over the next hour and a half, and we invite you most of all to be involved. How do you do it? You pick up the phone and you use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number's good anyway, your cat gets across the country or around the world on Blog Talk Radio or Spreaker, and also on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. And if you're shy about using the phone, that is no problem with us, because you can use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the phone is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. 34 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York. Our news notes section will be coming your way in our second half hour. But right now, joining me here in the Big Apple is the writer, producer, and director, and yes, the subject of the new HBO film, The Tale, premiering this Saturday night, starring Laura Dern, Jennifer Fox. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Jennifer, we're a few days away from having your film premiere. What's running through you right now?
I'm really excited to see how people react to it and what kind of new conversations the film sparks about memory, about trauma, and, of course, about child sexual abuse.
What kind of conversations do you want those of us who catch the program on Saturday to get or to start?
Well, first, you know, I just hope people go on a really exciting, you know, though difficult, but engaged journey through this story of a woman who's trying to figure out how and why she coded her memory in such a way when she was 13. And I think what the film will do is pull apart what people usually think about how these events happen and just shed a whole new light on it. And so it will get people starting to talk about their memory and how they think about their own lives and how they create themselves through the memories they have.
When at your career, because you've had a very great career as a documentary filmmaker, you've had several Emmy nominations, you've won a prize at the Sundance Film Festival, when did you decide, I'm going to take this haunting memory of my life, this demon, if you will, and I'm going to deal with it by dramatizing it for television. And I'm going to do it. I'm not going to let somebody else do it.
Well, first of all, you know, I'm an author, so I always think I'm going to tell the stories I want to tell. I always thought that this film had to be told in fiction because there is no evidence. It's all memories of mine and images and stories I wrote as a child or letters I have from my coaches back then. So it just seemed natural that it should be a fiction film. And for me as an artist, it was a kind of organic step to move from one language in film to another language. And it was perfect timing when I decided to make The Tale.
I want to welcome, by the way, guest 193 into our chat room. Simon Apple 04. By name, you have a question or a comment for Jennifer, put it in the room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. Did the decision to make this movie come because of one incident or because of snap decision, or was it something that was building up for you?
You know, I was in my mid-40s, and I was shooting a large piece. It was a six-hour piece called Flying Confessions of a Free Woman, which also played all over the world on television. And I was talking to women around the world of all classes and colors and nationalities. And suddenly, I just started to hear over and over again women telling me stories of what happened to them when they were teenagers or pre-teenagers that sounded just like my story. And my story, I had always called my first relationship with my 40-year-old coach. I was 13, he was 40. When I heard these women telling things that sounded exactly like the same sort of structure or paradigm as what happened to me, it was like a light bulb flipped on, and it was the first time I actually used the word sexual abuse for myself. And very soon after that, I thought, okay, now it's time for me to turn this into a film and investigate this in the way I know best, which is as a filmmaker.
Because this happened to you, I don't want to use the word easy, because that's, I think, a very unfortunate word to use. But when you decide we're going to put this together, I'm going to put this together, I'm writing this, was there an immediate block? Or because you had all the details, you had written accounts, you had your stories, that you found it, that there was a comfort level to putting this film together, the writing of it?
You know, those are really good questions. I think the reality is kind of neither. It would be easy if the film was just written in a straight narrative in the past tense in the events in 1973. And in fact, I did that in year one. I just wrote the script in 1973. And after a while, I looked at it and thought, oh my God, this is not the story I want to tell. I really want to tell a story about memory and about how an adult can actually, or a child actually, can decide to code something in a certain way in order to become the woman she wants to be. So these are very complicated ideas. Once you start dealing with memory, it's ephemeral. And I felt like I just threw out everything I knew about script writing and had to start from scratch and just started writing like these couplets of memory. And eventually I gathered, you know, 200 or 300 pages of these things. And also I started to do research into the real people now and weave that together with my memory, with my diaries. And it was a long, exciting, but not kind of, you know, predictable process to come up with a script. And I think that's why the tale is so unusual. It's really an investigation into one woman's memory about what she thought as a child and what she did as a child and how she used that to become an adult. Are you there?
To memory. Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear your question. I'm so sorry you cut out.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jennifer. How did your work as a documentary maker help you in making the script? Because you just said you call it an investigation. It is somewhat an investigation into your past. It's an investigation into memory of it and through the character that we'll talk about Laura Dern's performance in a moment. But how did your documentary work help you to make this script?
I think more than anything, I mean, one, of course, you know, I'm a documentarian, so I love research. So, you know, the whole present tense journey, which Laura Dern is playing me, Jennifer, looking for the real people now when she's, you know, pushed by her mother, played by Ellen Burstyn, to find the real people. And I made that real journey and found the children that were around me when I was 13 in 1973 and then the coaches. So that piece is definitely from my documentary experience. But the other thing that being a documentary maker gave me is a sense of just leaving the story wide open until you figure it out. You know, when you make documentaries, you can research for years. And I actually took a long time to write the script and just left the door open until I figured out what actually constructed memory in film.
You're hearing Jennifer Fox. She is the writer, producer, and director of HBO's latest original movie, The Tale, which is based on her personal experience. It stars Laura Dern, who last won Emmy Award for another HBO project, the first season of Big Little Lies. The miniseries will be coming back for a second season next year. The program premieres this Saturday at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time, and Jennifer's with us live here in New York. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. I'm Applebaum, live from New York. Delighted you're with us, whether you're catching us on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you have a question or comment for our guest, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room. Simon Apple 04, my name is 193 is in the room. Coming Friday out of the program, we will have the executive producers of the brand new Netflix series, The Break, with Michelle Wolf, Dan Powell, and Christine Nagel. It's Dan Powell, Christine Nagel from The Break. That's Michelle Wolf's new Netflix series, premiering soon, and they'll be with us live Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. Our lead guest on Tomorrow will be televised. Once the film got into production, how long did it take to cast Laura Dern as you?
Well, actually, Laura Dern was cast very early, and that's because a fellow filmmaker and friend, Brian De Palma, was, you know, around when I was writing the script and was really excited by it. And one day we were having coffee, and he was like, you know, Jennifer, who are you going to cast? And I said, well, we have the short list, and I brought out this little piece of paper, and he said, you know, took his finger and said, Laura Dern, she's the only actress with the guts to play this part, and I'm going to call her. And he literally, you know, opened his cell phone, called his agent, got her number, and called her, and basically pitched me as a filmmaker and also the script to her, sent it to her. And then another friend and someone who'd already come on to produce the film, Oren Moverman, actually weighed in with her as well and called her and said, you know, you've got to do this film. Jennifer's wonderful and the script is amazing. Anyhow, long story short, she read it and she was in town with her dad promoting Nebraska, and we met for breakfast and we talked, and at the end of like an hour and a half, she said, I'll do it. And she actually came onto the project a year and a half before we had any financing for it. And, you know, the rest is history. And she's just been such an incredible supporter of the film.
Jennifer, were you aware that she had a great track record with HBO? She's been nominated three times for her made-for-TV movie work with that network. She won for Big Little Lies. Of course, she's also a double Oscar nominee as well. And I still remember one of her breakthrough early performances when she was the blind girl in Mask, Derek Stotts, in that role.
Absolutely.
And of course, she was also in the HBO series Enlightened, which was an incredible performance, I thought.
Yeah, I remember her in Smooth Talk, which is just phenomenal as well. I mean, of course, I just am a huge fan of hers. That her, she had a long relationship with HBO didn't occur to me because at the time we were making an independent film. And, you know, in a huge surprise move, HBO only bought the film at Sundance when it premiered this January. And, in fact, HBO doesn't buy films, so this is a big anomaly for them. They just loved the film and thought it was perfect for their audience. And they bid on it against other theatrical distributors, and we just decided that they were going to handle the film better than anybody and get it to millions and millions of viewers, and we decided to go with HBO. So that was surprising and wonderful. We're thrilled they're taking it out.
How much time did you and Laura spend together to really pour your life into her?
We talked a lot. I also showed her this film, Flying Confessions of a Free Woman, that I'm in as myself, as the protagonist of that six-part series. And she watched that as Ellen Burstyn watched my mom. My mom is in that series. And so I think it was a combination. She watched that. We talked. I sent her the letters from my coaches when I was 13. I sent her my diaries from 13. I sent her The Tale. I sent her a slew of photographs and also interviews I'd done with the real people now. So she's steeped herself in the part. And in fact, many of my friends can't believe how well she kind of grokked me in the role. On the other hand, you know, Laura also brings, you know, incredible improvisational talent. And she, you know, the role of Jennifer in the film is a combination of me and truthfulness of me, but it's also her incredible artistic, you know, contribution to make this character that really functions on the screen.
As director, what was the most important thing for you that you said, not just to her, but to Ellen Burstyn and the other members of the cast, about how you wanted them to showcase this film in terms of their roles?
You know, for me, I think events like this are often portrayed in kind of hysterical ways in the media. You know, oh, my God, she's been abused. Oh, my God, you know, he's a predator. He's terrible, and very sort of black and white terms. And, of course, these events are terrible, and they're horrible for the people they happen to and the families. But the reality is that most people, most children that are abused, 93% know they're abusers. They're either family members, friends of the family, coaches, teachers, religious figures, etc. And they're esteemed by the community. And these events happen in very ordinary, quiet ways. And they aren't, you know, things that you see right off. Predators don't look like evil people. And many women who survive sexual abuse, and men too, are functioning part of the communities, and you would never know that they have this secret event or hurt in their life. So I wanted everyone to actually play the roles in different ways than they would normally imagine. They're not horrifically angry. They're not, you know, Laura plays a character incredibly well who has a lovely partner played by Common. They're happy. She has a good sex life. And she's functioning. She's got a good career. So this is we're really showing these roles differently than they've ever been seen.
Are you surprised, by the way, at the level of cast that you have? Because it's not just Laura Dern, it's not just Ellen Burstyn. You got Francis Conroy, one of the stars of Six Feet Under. You got John Hurd, wonderful actor. See his career blossom all over the place. You mentioned Common, who has
Don't
not only been terrific in front of the camera, behind the camera, too. It's a really incredible. Jason Ritter, who was just in Kevin Probably Saves the World on ABC. I mean, it's an incredible cast.
The cast is phenomenal, and frankly, you know, in part, of course, that's the script really, really spoke to people, but we also had an incredible team. Like I said, Brian De Palma just as a supporter, but Oren Moverman really lent his name and his weight behind this film to help cast it. We had Game Changer Films come in to finance it. We had people, you know, everyone on the cast. Don't forget Elizabeth Debicki was phenomenal, and little Isabel Nolise, who plays Jenny at 13. But anyway, we could go on and on. I mean, really, the actors just said, this is a role we have to do. This is a story we have to tell. And people say to me, I'm courageous. But frankly, I think the actors were just as courageous, because we shot this film before the Me Too movement, before Time's Up, and everybody was taking a big risk.
The Tale is the tale that we are talking about. It's a new original film from HBO, and it premieres this Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. Then it will replay on HBO and on other HBO services available on smart TV sets and smart devices throughout the month of June. We're talking with its writer, producer, director, remarkable person, Jennifer Fox. She joins us here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted you are with us, wherever you're catching us on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Any other question or comment for Jennifer, please get involved. Call in 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You will find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. We will not be with you next Monday. We normally would be, but it's Memorial Day weekend. We want to make sure you get a full and wonderful weekend. But we will be with you on Tuesday, and we'll be with you 2 hours later than normal. So check the special time, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. That's 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. And our lead guest will be the award-winning filmmaker Joe Bellinger. His newest work is on Stars. It's a miniseries called Wrong Man. Remember the opposite movie, The Wrong Man? You got a little bit of a sense of what this new Stars miniseries is all about. He's the executive producer and co-director. Joe Bellinger for Wrong Man on Stars, which premieres in June. He's with us next Tuesday at a special time, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Was there any point along the way that you second-guessed yourself?
Tell me what you mean by second-guessed yourself.
Where you were about to direct a scene or put your actors in a particular, maybe a very sensitive position, and you like, I don't know if this is going to go. I got to do some changes here. I have to change the script, or I have to change the environment, or something like that.
You know, I would say no, because the film, you know, in the writing, I was just really, you know, have a meter about authenticity. And the most important thing for me was the film was to be authentic. And I am quite a huge source in the story because it is my memory. And it's not a forgotten memory. It's something I remember quite clearly down to whole, you know, several dialogues that are actually in the film. So second guess, no. I think what's really difficult is this: the film has sensitive scenes with a minor, and those are heavily constructed in the shooting of them. And we had to, for example, shoot Isabel Nolis as a minor on a vertical bed standing up, and I was actually talking her through non-sexual cues just to get the expressions that would work in the scenes to be intercut with Jason Ritter, who was working with a body double. So there were things that we had to work out. Okay, how do we actually get that in a way that is very sensitive to all those involved, especially working with a minor and, you know, animals. We had horses, so things like that. But these are, you know, normal precautions when you're doing a film of this nature. The first thing you have to say is nobody should be harmed or hurt when making the film.
Is there closure for you now that this film is about to be presented?
That's a great question. You know, people ask me that. Okay, now is the trauma over? Well, you know, frankly, the trauma made me who I am today in many ways. I would say you never completely get rid of trauma. It's always there as a shadow inside of you and informs who you are and what you do. Has it changed? Has the story changed in my mind? Am I a different person now that I've met it? Absolutely. But I will be another different person in a year also. So it has provoked change, but the change is ongoing.
Well, when you started this, Jennifer, as I mentioned at the top, there was no Me Too, there was no Time's Up, other civil movements like this. Now there are. It certainly has had a tremendous social impact, and the impact is still being felt. Where do you hope that these movements go? And secondly, where do you want to see your career go? Do you want to do more scripted work, whether it's series or original movies? Do you want to go back to documentary work? Where do you see your career post this?
Sure. In terms of, you know, this film is, you know, a continuation of the Me Too and Time's Up movement, and it's actually breaking yet another, you know, wall, which is the whole taboo of child sexual abuse. The movement is mostly talked about adults, so this is like the next taboo. And what I really hope is that the film helps continue and open this conversation to really look at how complex and nuanced and messy child sexual abuse is. And I hope the movement continues and opens up more and more so that we no longer tolerate or hide these things when they happen as just, okay, you're a woman, this is what you have to live with because you're not allowed to talk about it. In terms of my career, I absolutely want to do more fiction. You know, narrative is the most exciting edge for me as an artist. I just feel like it's, you know, the new practice for me. And, you know, I'm looking at narrative scripts. I'm looking at books. I'm a writer and love writing. I love writing my own work, but I'm also looking for works that other people have written, and I'm really interested in telling stories that matter, but with a creative language that is new and fresh.
Two other points before we wrap. Number one, very diverse crew, both in front of and behind the camera on this film, including many, many women. And secondly, earlier today, Daniel Feinberg, who is the Emmy prognosticator for The Hollywood Reporter, mentioned that there is a very good chance, according to his prognostication, that both the film and Laura Dern's performance could be Emmy Award contenders this summer. The film is The Tale, and it premieres on HBO this Saturday at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Check your local regions where HBO is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the film online, www.hbo.com. That's www.hbo.com. The Tale. It's a very special one and a very personal one, too. Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Writer, director, producer, and subject, Jennifer Fox, thank you very, very much for coming on. I really appreciate it. So does our audience. Good luck with this film, and hopefully you continue on being the great filmmaker you are.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are very, very welcome. All the greatest to you, Laura, and the cast and crew. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Writer, director, producer, and subject of The Tale, Jennifer Fox, joining us live from New York. More Tsunami televised in a moment. But first, some words from the fine folks at Audible.com and Amazon Company. Big shout out to the 59 independent pilot creators who are going to be in contention in the major category for the upcoming New York Television Festival. It's a major lineup of a lot of different elements to it: comedy, drama, animation, live action, scripted, unscripted. Also, many of these entries are by women, many by people of color, and they'll all be going for the opportunity to be seen by the public and by network executives, and who knows what that will lead to in their television careers. It's all coming up at the New York Television Festival, taking place this July here in New York at the Helen Mills Theater and the FCA Theater, and for the second straight year, it is being sponsored in part by Audible.com, and they want to say congratulations to all of the pilot contenders, as well as other pilot makers who will be in other categories as well. And incidentally, if you haven't heard, Audible.com is not only giving you the opportunity to see and read some of the best books around in audio form, but also they're doing original audio programming, including Work Now with Reese Witherspoon's company, Hello Sunshine. And that's why it's more important than ever that Audible can transform the way you hear the world. But the only way you find out, get a free trial for yourself. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital entertainment and information with over 108,000 titles to choose from. You listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio or Speaker, as well as iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Remember, just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. It's audibletrial.com/televised. You get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of their service. And remember that they give you great customer service because Audible is owned by Amazon.com, one of the great leaders in customer service around the world. So get a free trial, get a free book from the great selection that they have, and hear for yourself why Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world, because for them, listening is the new reading. Again, for that free audio book, one-month trial, and great, great listening pleasure, hours of it, audibletrial.com/televised. This is Tsunami Televised. We're the promo about the Tsunami, and we're just getting started on this special 90-day edition of our program on this midweek, 74 degrees at the top of the hour. We've got coming your way in the next half hour alone. We have news notes. We have our classic trivia question of the week. And coming up, we will have the executive producer of a popular series on Animal Planet that is about to end its run after 100 episodes. The 100th appears this Sunday night. His name is Keith Hoffman. The program is Finding Bigfoot, and it also will kick off a new Monsters Week on Animal Planet. So he's going to be joining me here in New York in the next half hour. And then our final half hour, we will cover Los Angeles, and we will speak with the noted civil rights attorney, Benjamin Crump, who is host and executive producer of an important new series running next month on TV One. It's called Evidence of Innocence. And we'll get to him, as I said, in our following and final half hour, along with another segment about one of the guests that we had on this past Friday, who is executive directs the Georgia Film Academy. Remember, if you want to catch up on episodes you missed, we make it very easy for you. Go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check them out there. You can also go to iTunes.com, Apple TV's iTunes podcast app, the Speaker Podcast Radio app, and, of course, the iHeartRadio Podcast Network at iHeartRadio.com. We come back. News notes. And our next guest, Keith Hoffman, executive producer of Finding Bigfoot on Animal Planet. He joins me here at the Big Apple after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are Texas' best internet radio on the planet, blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. And we're simulcasting live on speaker.com. Millions more tuning in from there. And it's your home for What's the Buzz NYC. Check out Nancy Lombardo with her topical talk and comedy every week, various times, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, the best VTR is available 24/7 wherever you find YouTube. And don't forget, YouTube is available on most smart TV sets and smart TV devices. Welcome back to more of Tomorrow We Televised. 90-minute edition coming your way this Wednesday, 74 degrees at the top of the hour. Delighted to have you aboard. More great guests coming your way in the hour ahead, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, your voice. And you dialing in at 646-652-2906 or using our chat room, Simon Apple 04 Menangius 193 is in the room. Keith Hoffman from Animal Planet Series Finding Bigfoot will join me here in the Big Apple. But first, we have some news notes for you. Matt Groening's latest TV creation, Disenchantment, opens on Netflix August 17th. This new tune from The Simpsons originator takes place in Dreamland, a medieval kingdom where misadventures happen to Princess Bean, elf companion Elfo, that matters, and personal demon Lucy. And again, that's starting on August 17th. Is Captain Kangaroo making a 21st century comeback? Well, that's what actor-entrepreneur Mark Wahlberg wants to pull off. Kangaroo, one of the all-time classic weekend series for young people, ran on CBS from 1955 to 1984, with several years of replay on PBS. In an interview on Ellen DeGeneres' syndicated talk hour this week, Wahlberg said the new Kangaroo would focus on science and technology topics. No word yet on who will play Captain K, made world-famous by Bob Keeshan, or where and when it will run. A round of quickies for you now. Shark Week turns 30 on Discovery Channel July 22nd. Yes, the new program includes a first-ever special involving the sharks of Shark Tank. Freeform spin-off of The Fosters, which wraps up its tenure there next month, now has a name, Good Trouble. Production of the spin-off begins later this summer. The much-anticipated Miz and Mrs. miniseries involving the WWE Intercontinental Champion wrestler The Miz and wife Maryse begins July 24th on USA Network. And Boomerang will add at least two new series next year, Scooby-Doo and Guess Who, and Yabba Dabba Dinosaurs updating those kids from the Flintstones, Pebbles, and Bam Bam. And that is our news notes for today. We'll have our up segment coming your way in our next half hour. But right now, joining me here in New York is the executive producer of the popular Animal Planet series, Finding Bigfoot, Keith Hoffman. Keith, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
So this weekend, Memorial Day weekend, you wrap up 100 episodes of Finding Bigfoot. Why now wrapping things up?
Well, you know, it's bittersweet because it's been a really fun journey with these guys looking. And, you know, we really made a decision. It was a really hard decision that we wanted to end while we still felt like we were on top. You know, the series is still very loved, very popular. You know, the guys are all still looking on their own and with each other, but without the cameras following them. So we just wanted to end with it's a really fun episode. They go back to where it all started in Willow Creek, and we thought it was just a good way to give an ending to this. So we don't want people to get tired of us.
How did it start in the first place, for those who have not been with the show from the start?
We had someone here at Animal Planet who was a huge Bigfoot enthusiast, and he met some producers who were also Bigfoot enthusiasts, and we came together and we decided we wanted to get, you know, the people who were the most passionate in their search for Bigfoot. And, you know, obviously we know there's a lot of skeptics out there, but there are a lot of people who have had experiences that they swear was an encounter with a Bigfoot, and, you know, three members of our team, we have one skeptic, but the three guys on our team just have seen Bigfoots. They believe with all their hearts. They were out looking, so we decided we would follow them as they search for Bigfoot. And, you know, honestly, a lot of people on this end thought, how can that be more than one episode? Who's going to want to watch it past one episode? And but, you know, 100 episodes later, people are still watching it.
When this quartet started their journey many moons ago, what was their attitude about what they were trying to find? Because some people have this idea of Bigfoot being like the worst monster in the world, and some people have this idea of Bigfoot sort of comparable to King Kong. He's like this gentle, sweet creature that, if he was ever found, would really show, for those who think he's a monster, the total opposite.
Yeah, they are definitely of the second group. One of their pet peeves is that people think of Bigfoot as some kind of, you know, mean creature, you know, it's going to attack people. And they actually believe quite the opposite, that, you know, it's a very smart animal, very, you know, elusive. And to be that elusive, you have to be smart. And that really wants to be left alone. And, you know, society's kind of, and civilization's kind of encroaching on their territory, that really would rather avoid people. So they wanted to show people that, you know, that this wasn't a dangerous creature. And, you know, I think one thing that's really happened that has been really exciting is, and they were very surprised when it started, that, you know, kids got very excited by the idea that maybe there's things we all haven't discovered yet. And, you know, it really got kids, like going out in nature and thinking about, you know, can they, you know, see a Bigfoot for themselves. So they are happy about that. You know, they're not worried kids are going to go out there and be attacked by a Bigfoot. They love that. There's this sense of wonder about this this animal, and that they've, you know, they feel proud they've helped inspire that.
Bigfoot seems to have this aura as American legend, American folklore. Why do you think that is, let's say, compared to wannabes who would very well, if they had the notoriety, could sort of aspire to that level of folkloric icon?
I mean, I think, you know, Bigfoot is feels like a very American creature, although we have looked all over the world, but there are different types. And obviously there's the Yeti, which is, you know, thought of as a cousin of the Bigfoot. But, you know, Bigfoot has been in, something I didn't know until I started working on this series is that, you know, almost every Native American tribe has the Bigfoot legend in their tribe. And that is one of the things you think, like, you know, how did this collective thing happen if there isn't some basis of it? In a lot of totem poles, there are Bigfoots, you know, these creatures that what we describe as Bigfoots that are exactly like that. So it has been in our collective conscious in our culture, you know, since before, when the Native Americans still lived, you know, were here before everyone else. So it really is kind of uniquely part of our culture, I feel like, and it has been for a very, very long time.
Finding Bigfoot is one of Animal Planet's most popular series the last couple of years, and this Sunday night it all comes to a conclusion with episode number 100. But that's not all. It's also the kickoff of Animal Planet's annual Monsters Week. We'll talk more about that as we go forward this half hour. Keith Hoffman, who is the executive producer of Bigfoot, is with us right here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow Tell Live. He'd love to hear from you. So give us a call, 646-652-2906. At 646-652-2906. The numbers get anywhere. Your catchers across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, a speaker. And we have guest 195 in our chat room. Simon Apple 04 by name. So if you're shy about using the phone, use that room. That's why it is there. Coming up Friday on our program, our regular time period, 3:30 Eastern New Pacific, we'll have the executive producers of Netflix's new series, The Break, with Michelle Wolf. It's executive producers Dan Powell and Christine Mangle. They're both with us live at our first guest, Friday, 3:30 Eastern New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Before you went ahead with this series, did you get a lot of proposals about Bigfoot or things like that? And once you decided to go forward with this program, why this quartet of people? What about them and their passion about finding Bigfoot said to you and the Animal Planet people, let's throw our lock and stock with them?
I think it really was their passion, and I believe that their passion is what why people have loved this series for so long. You know, it's an eclectic group. We have Matt Moneymaker, you know, Bobo, who people know the series, like, love Bobo. There's no one else like him in the world. We have Cliff, who takes more of a scientific angle. And so those three guys, like I said, they knew each other. They had all gone out looking together before for Bigfoot. And we just saw something in this combination that just said there's something about them that we think sparks. And then we did want to have a skeptic. And, you know, they weren't traveling around on their own with the skeptic. And so, you know, we looked around for someone who could join. And Matt Moneymaker knew this woman, Renee, who's a field biologist, whose father was very interested in Bigfoot. But she, you know, she was interested, but she didn't believe in Bigfoot. So we got them together, and a little bit of that, you know, I will say, I'd like to say I'm a total genius, and I thought this is going to be a huge hit if they get together, but, you know, a lot of it was the first time they got together, they went out, and we saw them on film. It was, you know, there's this chemistry, and, you know, working in television, when you find that chemistry, it's really kind of magic, and, you know, I would say these four could be just sitting in a car talking about Bigfoot, and they're interesting to watch. I, you know, I've seen 100 episodes, and I've hung out with them a lot, and I have never ceased to be surprised by them. You know, my favorite line, I'd just say, from Bobo, one time I said, you know, do you ever have moments you don't believe in Bigfoot? And he said to me, do you not believe in cats? I've seen a Bigfoot. How could I not believe in one? So, you know, something like that, I'm, you know, is always interesting to watch.
How far and wide have their travels taken them and you?
They have been in, I believe we've been in every state now. They even went out to Hawaii, which there are no Bigfoots in Hawaii. They can tell you that. They're, you know, they're not crazy. But they looked there and they didn't find any. But we have been in China, we've been in Nepal, where that's as far as I've been, if you're asking. I was in Nepal with them, which was just amazing, incredible, once-in-a-lifetime experience, you know, up in the most remote areas of Nepal. You know, and one thing about Bigfoot, they always say, you know, they're not going to be in the middle of a city somewhere. So even if they're within our country, you know, they're going out to areas of the country that there aren't a lot of people. And I would say something that I also learned in this series, like, I think sometimes we feel like, every, you know, mile of our country has been explored, but there is a lot of wilderness out there still. And, you know, that is where they go, to look for Bigfoot. But, you know, they've been, like Nepal, China, yeah, we've even been up in Scotland, but not really for Bigfoot. That was for, just, they wanted to go check out Loch Ness Monster Stories. But we've been all over the world pretty much, except, I think, South America.
Mm. I think you may have the idea of a spinoff show, Finding Loch Ness.
There you go.
When you were taping or filming overseas, especially in China, was there any problems with the authorities or the whatever they call their television commissions or television departments in terms of filming or taping over there, especially when you told them what the premise was?
I know, you know, it's what's interesting. First of all, we never went to a country, you know, one reason I say we haven't really been in South America is there's a few, there actually are, I don't want to say there are no sightings of Bigfoot, but, you know, they always went to places where people said that they had seen Bigfoot. So, you know, we started there. We didn't just go to any country to say, hey, we're just looking here. But I have to tell you, I was surprised by, in all these countries, these guys were welcome. This series is also known all over the world, too. So it's kind of hard to go somewhere where they weren't known, which also is sometimes a problem for us, because we didn't just want to have fans coming to tell them. We wanted to find real witnesses. And, you know, we have a really amazing team of producers who would go out ahead of our team just to start helping find witnesses. You know, how what we do is we'd have producers go out a few weeks ahead and just get the word out and try to get the best witnesses in, and then the witnesses would come and talk to our team, and then our team would decide, like, we're going to follow these stories to see, you know, they'd investigate stories. So we did have someone going out ahead and working out all the logistics. But, you know, when I was in Nepal, I mean, the kind of problems we had were just we were supposed to fly a plane up, you know, up into the mountains. And it's infamous, the landing, where it's like the smallest, I think, runway in the world that, like, backs, that goes right into a mountain at the end. And somebody on the crew had been on that before, and the plane ahead of him crashed, and the people died in it. So we were supposed to take that, and the weather was so bad that we waited for 3 days in Kathmandu in a tough airport, you know, it was a crowded airport. And we finally ended up having to take a helicopter up, which is its own kind of scary things, but, you know, nice things. So, you know, each one just had its own things of we had to have interpreters with us, but everybody honestly welcomed us.
In the course of doing these 100 episodes, did the group ever take tips from people using social media or calling the show who had some ideas of sightings that maybe they should check into? I'm curious how much participation the audience had in terms of where these people went.
Oh, definitely. You know, social media is the biggest way that they would take tips. So, and Matt Moneymaker is head of an organization called Bigfoot Research Organization, BFRO. And most of the tips came from them. They are kind of the central, you know, clearinghouse of tips. And, you know, he is very, you know, he doesn't believe just every tip that comes in. And they hate hoaxers. So he can kind of read something and just say, this sounds legitimate. You know, these kind of things I heard before. This one just sounds like a hoax, somebody who just wants to be famous on television, which, like I said, is their least favorite person. So definitely almost social media, and obviously once the show was out, they got a lot more tips, and they would really wade through to find the ones that they felt were really legitimate and worth investigating. And, you know, I think if you see on the show even ones that are that they're investigating, sometimes they decide that they are hoaxes too, or that it's a misidentification.
Mm-hmm. One of the great television experiences of all time, and very big in the 1960s, was the show The Fugitive, which may have had one of the great premises of any television series ever. You had the main character, Richard Kimball, who was on the run for a crime he didn't commit. And what made the show so fascinating was is that every week he had to be in a new disguise, in a new place, and with a new identity, while he was still trying to find the person that killed his wife and to prevent himself from being taken in by Lieutenant Gerard, played very well by Barry Morse. David Jantz, of course, was memorable as the fugitive. And I'm sure along the way in that series there were some close calls. But for finding Bigfoot, which is the real thing, what was the closest call?
You know, you ask of where you know, we've been. I mean, when you say the closest call, my feeling was we actually went down to Australia, and I wasn't with them, sadly. But Cliff was in this clearing, you know, one of our team members, and he suddenly could hear all around him. He could see eye shine and hear these noises, and then he would clap, and there'd be a clapping back, but it wasn't like, you know, hands clapping. It was, and that was one of my most, it was pretty great to watch. And the other thing, the person who's had the most near experiences is Renee, who is a skeptic. And it's always funny because she would just have like, she would capture things. She would see eye shine. I mean, she'd capture things on video, and but she still would be skeptical, and it made the guys crazy. They'd be like, you know, what more do you need? But she wanted to, you know, actually have the physical evidence. But, you know, you've given me a great idea for a spinoff is I wish we could do the show from Bigfoot's point of view, like you're talking where he's the fugitive, and have get it from his point of view as these people are trying to find him. So if I could do that series, that would be great.
I could see it now. You know, point of view. You have the use the micro cam or maybe a drone cam, or whatever, or a GoPro cam for a point of view, and that'd be kind of neat, kind of fun. Maybe as a one
know,
shot.
Maybe he goes in disguise.
Could be. Quinn Martin will love you for it. Rest that man's soul. We've got Keith Hoffman, the executive producer of Finding Bigfoot, which becomes 100 episodes and done this Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific time. And is also the kickoff of Monsters Week, an annual event on Animal Planet, which Rand has been for the last many years. And Keith joins us live in New York this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. You are aboard on this special Wednesday edition of our show. Have a question or comment for Keith? Got to quiz for a few more minutes. Don't be shy. Make the phone ring, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room. SimonApple04, my name, guest 193, is in the room. And coming your way on a special edition Tuesday, it's next Tuesday, not Monday because Memorial Day, but next Tuesday we're going to be coming your way at 5 p.m. Eastern, and that's 2 p.m. Pacific, and that is 2 hours later than normal. And our lead guest will be the award-winning filmmaker Joe Berlinger, whose latest work for television is Starz's miniseries Wrong Man. It's true, and it deals with people who may very well be innocent of the crimes they were committed in jail for. Wrong Man. Joe is the executive director, co-director of the series, and he'll be with us live. That's Tuesday, and that's May 29th, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. Note the special time right here exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. I mentioned The Fugitive a moment ago, and of course, one of the most memorable things about The Fugitive is that it ended with an ending where Richard Kimball found the one-armed man, found that he was the person that killed his wife, and was able to be exonerated of his crime. And at the time, there were a lot of people who questioned that move by Quentin Martin and Alan Arbor, the producer, and ABC for saying, like, you can't do this. You're going to screw up the syndication rights. And as it turned out, it was something that was the highest rated at the time, the highest viewed series conclusion, and one of the highest rated episodes of the series of all time. Do you wish, front and back of the mind, that finding Bigfoot could end the same way with Bigfoot being found?
Well, who says it doesn't? You haven't seen, I don't know if you've seen the last episode, but I think you have to tune in and see. I just want to say about this episode, you know, they go back to Willow Creek, which is where, you know, people who love Bigfoot know that Patterson-Gimlin, almost everyone knows Patterson-Gimlin. They just may not know the name, but it's a very iconic footage of Bigfoot that started everything. It's like the grainy but really clear home video of Bigfoot. And what they do in this final episode is they go back to that area, which is really they feel is the hotbed of Bigfoots. And they also, with new technology and also a new canister of film they found. I mean, it's crazy. We got this call from that where there's footage in it that is newly enhanced, and you can see this Bigfoot so clearly in this new footage. It is so cool, and you see details that make you, I'm telling you, because, you know, I have some skeptic in me, but there's details that you go, like, how could this be anything else? And it's really hard to figure out how this could be something in a costume when you see the details in this film. So you go back there, and they definitely have some good leads, and I'm not telling you how it ends. Nice try, though.
Okay, fair enough. By the way, this is not only the last episode, but it's also the first episode of this Monsters Week series of events that are happening on Animal Planet. Tell us about some of the other happenings that will be going on all week long.
Yeah, so Monster Week is really exciting. We're doing another it's hosted, I would say, by another great podcast, The Cryptid Factor, and it's Reese Darby, Dan Schreiber, and this guy named Buttons, and they just love everything, you know, monster, anything unexplained. So they're going to be doing wraparounds of every show. So it is kind of like we're looking at it as a little bit of a party. They add some humor to it, but also they are really serious about this. And, you know, we're looking at Bigfoot, obviously, also Yeti. There's a show called The Lost Kingdom of the Yeti, which I also worked on, which is they also get some DNA evidence that I cannot explain. And there's Show Fear Island about in Alaska, this island full of bears, and legend has it the largest bear ever. And there's another show where they explore octopuses. I mean, we're in land, sea, forest, everywhere you want. It's really like a celebration of monsters. It's a lot of fun. You know, there's a lot of heavy things happening in the world, and you know, this is just a fun week, and you can watch it with your kids, and I think it's really enjoyable. I've seen all the shows. It's all great. Very proud of it.
What do you hope, what do you hope the legacy of Finding Bigfoot would be? What do you think is its biggest contribution to not just television, but biggest contribution to maybe our understanding of the natural world and sometimes the unnatural elements that we can't see?
To me, I think the two things that I feel proud and I really hope I think it really instilled a sense of wonder in people and in the idea that, you know, instead of cynicism that everything has been discovered, that there really are mysteries out there. And I think, I know I yearned for that. I love knowing that I don't know everything and I can be surprised. And there's actually things that feel even kind of magical. And, you know, the whole animal kingdom can do that. So I really, you know, I think that, and like I said, especially with kids, I truly believe that kids, I've met so many fans of the show. They're going to grow up and have a, you talked about The Fugitive and you have this like fond feeling of this. I really think kids are going to grow up and really have a fond, special memory of this series. And that makes me really proud because I think we all have that. We all have those things that we loved as kids that grew up with. And, you know, it's for kids and adults, but that's just something that I feel is very special. I think this will continue long after this series.
Episode 100, episode final of Finding Bigfoot, one of the most popular programs in the history of Animal Planet, comes your way on that network this Sunday night of Memorial Day weekend, 8:10 Eastern and Pacific Time. Check out for where Animal Planet is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the show online, go to www.animalplanet.com. That's www.animalplanet.com. Don't forget that Finding Bigfoot's last episode is also the first episode of Monsters Week. We'll be running all week long on Memorial Day Monday and the rest of the week as well. By the way, there'll be a special episode of one of my favorite shows, Animal Planet, River Monsters, one of the long-running ones. If you've never seen River Monsters, River Monsters is a wonderful show. I think one of the best nature shows in all television. And I'm surprised it still doesn't get enough attention by a lot of the critics. It's really, really super. And that's also one of the special episodes, part of Monsters Week. Again, it all kicks off with Finding Bigfoot this Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. Keith Hoffman, the executive producer of Finding Bigfoot, thank you much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Good luck with you and your crew on episode 100. A big, big finale for that, a big, big kickoff of Monsters Week as well. It's been delightful to have you aboard.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a super weekend. Take care.
You too.
Keith Hoffman, executive producer of Finding Bigfoot from Animal Planet, joining us live in New York. And now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. We still have a winner of the question post on Monday, and that's where we're going to ask it again. And it's a tribute to New Girl, the Fox series that wrapped up its multi-year run earlier this month. Here's the question. Where did New Girl live before moving to Los Angeles? Where did New Girl live? That's the character played by Zoe Deschanel. Where did New Girl live before moving to Los Angeles? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please include your name and your full name and address. And if you're first the correct answer, you will win the Mary Shelley Frankenstein, the paperback from National Geographic. Shelley is going to be the subject of the third season of Genius, the Emmy-nominated series that starred Jeffrey Rush as Albert Einstein last year, and currently with Antonio Banderas as Pablo Picasso. So again, if you want to win the paperback version from Nat Geo of Frankenstein, email me with your answer to our classic trivia question this week. One more time, where did New Girl live before moving to Los Angeles? SimonApple04 is where you go, yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from. And if you missed the question just now, we'll try to do it one more time before we wrap up today's episode. If not, post it tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, in order to win, be in, and all the very best. This is Tomorrow We Televise, the program about the Tube. We do Monday and Friday, usually, 3 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Don't forget, next Tuesday, we're joining you at a special time, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. Our first guest will be the executive producer and director of the Starz miniseries coming next month, Wrong Man, Joe Berlinger, award-winning filmmaker. So check him out. That's going to be next Tuesday, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. And remember, you can catch the podcast version of our show anytime you like, and you can catch it at iTunes.com. Apple TV's iTunes podcast app, the Spreaker podcast radio app, and, of course, the IR Radio Podcast Network. Go to www.irradio.com, put Tomorrow We Televise in the search bar, click, and you are in. When we come back, live from Los Angeles, the noted civil rights attorney Benjamin Stump will be with us in an internet radio exclusive. His new series for TV One premieres next month. It's called Evidence of Innocence. And we will have him after he pauses at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, your home for the Kia D Unplugged Show, one of the sneak shows in all of radio. Check it out Mondays, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. It's music, it's comedy, it's fun, and a whole lot more. The Kia D Unplugged Show, Mondays, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR 24/7, always on YouTube. Welcome back to Tomorrow We Tell Live, and welcome to those who are just joining us at the top of the hour on Blog Talk Radio, simulcasting on Spreaker. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Glad you are with us on this Wednesday afternoon, special midweek edition of our show, coming into the last half hour of this 90 edition, and we're happy you've been with us along the way, and happy that those of you just joining us are doing so. Great guests coming your way this half hour ahead. Be part of the program. Give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 0419, guest 193 is in the room. Our final guest today is one of the most noted civil rights attorneys around. He is also the host and producer of a new series on TV One premiering Monday, June 4th at 10 Eastern and Pacific time. It's called Evidence of Innocence. Joining us live from Los Angeles in an interview exclusive, Benjamin Crump. Hello, Benjamin. Welcome in.
Hi. How you doing?
Very, very fine. Thank you. Tell us about your program and why you decided to take part in it.
Certainly. After fighting on the front lines for the families of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, who was killed, it's hard to believe, over 6 years ago, now walking home with a can of iced tea and a bag of Skittles, minding his business. And Michael Brown, 18-year-old young African-American who was killed in broad daylight by the Ferguson police and countless others. I was approached about doing a television show to try to speak to the injustices that often happen at that unfortunate ill will to people of color. And so what I did, I said I would try to do a show that really let people see firsthand accounts of how terribly unfair and unequal the criminal justice system can be to people of color. And that's when we started talking about the cause for the wrongfully convicted. People who are 100% innocent, but yet they are sentenced and convicted of crimes they didn't commit, and they spend 10, 20, 27, 30 years in prison. And so starting June 4th at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9 o'clock Central, every Monday on TV One, we're going to have these stories of who the American criminal justice system tried to define as the worst that society had to offer. But I invite you to watch their stories and see their response to the injustices that they had to suffer. And I'm sure you will conclude, like I did, that really these young people of color were the best that American society had to offer, because after they were exonerated of clear and convincing evidence, I mean proof that they never committed any crime, after spending decades in prison, came out and they were not spewing hate and bitterness. They were saying it was hate that put me in prison. It was love that got me out. And hate is its own form of prison. So I'm not going to be hateful. And that's what we're dealing with when you hear these stories of people going into prison as teenagers, coming out as 45 and 46-year-old men and women. And so it's an important show that people who are going to be prospective future jurors need to watch, so they won't believe everything that the prosecutor says and disbelieve everything that the poor people of color say.
Why did, in the case of the subjects we're going to see in this series, why did clearly the justice system fail them? Was it a case of the evidence that would prove them free of the crime, free and clear of the crime, not show up? Was it a case of the prosecution's case was just so strong? Or was it a case of they were the easiest suspects to put in jail?
Simon, you hit it right on the nail. As I speak around the country at universities and law schools and different organizations, I tell people, because I always try to speak truth to power. My mother and my grandmother taught me, baby, if you ever get a chance to speak truth to power, you do it. Simon, you have a very powerful radio audience all across America, and so I'm attempting to speak a truth that many people don't want to hear, and that is the fact that in the American criminal justice system, the easiest thing to do is to convict a black or brown person of a crime. to have any evidence at all. You can have innuendo, say they fit a description, and that is enough to take their liberty away from them and put them in an 8x10 cell for years upon years of their life. And so that's what we're battling. The Innocence Project believes that there are 100,000 people sitting in American prisons completely 100% innocent of the crime, but because we have the intellectual justification of discrimination amongst our legal system, people who are poor and minority oftentimes don't have the resources to adequately challenge the evidence and the witnesses against them being offered by the government. And so they go years incarcerated until lawyers or people of goodwill and morals come to their aid and try to make sure they get their due process of the law, make sure that they get their constitutional rights, that is, to face the evidence and the witnesses against you in the court of law. And you see, in many of these cases, the prosecutors either knew or should have known that these were innocent people, but yet they did not care. And that's what I mean when it's the intellectual justification of discrimination.
Talk to me about how you sense that fine line that you just mentioned, which is either they know or they don't care. How do you sense that? And particularly with these four cases that are in this series, and we'll get to the cases in a little bit, but how do you sense that at work as opposed to something else in the system?
Well, Simon, when you are a prosecutor and you say to a jury of citizens that we have overwhelming evidence of this person's guilt, and it's based on something that you know you don't have, and then 14 years later, when there's finally competent lawyers on the other side that say, produce this evidence, and you tell them we don't have it, then it's pretty clear that the prosecutors either misled, deceived, or straight out lied in the courtroom. They're not held accountable. Nothing happens to them. And these people who said, I'm innocent, I didn't do it, and they said they didn't do it for years, are left holding the bag. What is so inspiring about Evidence of Innocence, this show, it's unlike any other show that is on television. When you think about all these criminal reenactment shows, Simon, you have, you know, the Forensic File type shows, the Law and Order, Snap, all these things. They premise justice on locking them up and throwing away the key. Well, Evidence of Innocence, we premise justice on searching and getting to the truth and getting people who have been wrongfully convicted out of prison. And it's so special because their families, in many of these instances, never gave up on them. Can you imagine having a child, a young child, late teens, early 20s, get wrongfully incarcerated of a crime, and the judge sentenced them to 30 years, 40 years, 50 years in prison? And you say, well, this can't be right. This can't be right. It's going to be shown that my child is innocent. 1 year go by. 2 years go by, 5 years go by, 10 years go by, but yet you keep believing in their innocence, keep saying there's something wrong here. You never give up on them. It's many instances where it was the family love and support and their faith that got them through this, because how would you survive if you was in a prison and you know you didn't commit the crime, but yet you serve your 21st birthday in prison, your 25th birthday in prison, your 30th birthday in prison? I mean, it's enough to drive you crazy, but yet these people found a way to survive. And what's even more special, Simon, they found a way after they were finally proven innocent that they were not going to be bitter. They were not going to let this miscarriage of justice define their life and their existence on this earth.
You are hearing live from Los Angeles the noted civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, and he is the host and the executive producer of TV1's new series, Evidence of Innocence. It premieres Monday, June 4th at 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, and we have it live from L.A. this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted you are with us on this special midweek edition of the Promo About Television. And if you have a question or a comment for our guest, give us a call. 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Again, coming your way Friday on Smart Be Televised at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, we will kick it off with executive producers of the brand new series, The Break, with Michelle Wolf. That's on Netflix. We'll have Dan Powell and Christine Nangle. That's this Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Benjamin, how were these cases selected? And especially starting off with the first one, which will be coming up on June 4th, dealing with a woman named Lisa Roberts, whose ex-girlfriend is murdered in Portland, Oregon. She becomes the prime suspect. She swears, I'm innocent, I got my alibi. And the prosecutors come back at her and say, no, you're not. We got cell phone evidence that proves you did it, and we're going to give you two options. Either get manslaughter or go to trial and risk even more time in prison. She takes the plea, and there we go from there.
Absolutely. And so, Simon, to answer your first question, the cases were selected. Obviously, there are thousands upon thousands of cases that we could have selected. But because this was a limited series, we sought to find the cases that were most compelling, that affected some of the greatest numbers of people, and different things that people now have to understand. Discrimination comes in many different forms and fashions. For instance, Lisa Roberts was a black woman living in Portland, Oregon, who was a homosexual. She was openly gay, and she had her ex-lover and her had their family, and they were not welcome in the mid-80s. You know, here in America now, we progressed a long way, but back at that time, it was frowned upon. You had an interracial couple, an openly gay couple, and people did not like it. So when her ex-lover was murdered, nobody stood for Lisa Roberts, even though she had never, ever been convicted of any crime in her life. She was an honorably discharged veteran, had fought for the country, served the country, but yet when she was accused of this heinous crime, even though she had an alibi witness, the prosecutor and the police sought her out and her alone, even when they had the killer right there amongst them. They never even looked to him. They only focused in on her. And that was the only person they was making sure they were going to convict of this crime. And so when she was given this Hobson's choice, you plea, and we will give you 15 years in prison, trial, and once you're convicted, we're going to give you a life sentence. You know, and so that was her choices. They had young children that they were raising together. She cared deeply for these children. And so she said, based on the advice of her lawyer, that you're a poor woman, you're a black woman, you're a gay woman, nobody is going to support you, Lisa Roberts, and you should go ahead and plead and take the 15 years or you're going to die in prison. That was what her lawyer told her. And she said, but I'm innocent. I have an alibi. He said, it doesn't matter. Based on this discrimination that exists, if you don't take this plea, you will die in prison. So she took the plea, but she kept professing her innocence. She continued to fight it over and over for 14 years. I mean, she was finally let out of prison almost 14 years later. It was 13 years and 9 months. She had been fought and maintaining her innocence. And it wasn't till there were good public defenders who understood that not only was she facing discrimination because she was black and she was a woman, but she was facing discrimination because she was openly gay. And so they took up the cause of Lisa Roberts, and it is astounding. I mean, Simon, when you watch episode one on June 4th, the case of Lisa Roberts, to see the deceit that is offered by the prosecutor and the police, it is outrageous on so many levels. They knew she was innocent, but yet they still convicted her of this crime. And that's what I mean when I say Lisa is one of the best people, because she's still not bitter. And the other thing, what we're trying to do with this show, Simon, is affect the hearts and minds of future prospective jurors out there to make sure they hold the prosecutors and the police to their responsibility when they say guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and the fact that they don't just accept anything that the prosecutors say as the gospel, and they disbelieve the poor minorities who are saying I'm innocent. We are trying to get to the hearts and minds and say justice isn't about locking people up and throwing away the key. Justice is about getting to the truth. Lisa Roberts deserved the truth to be known, and that's what this show is about. In some way, it's a small measure of justice for Lisa Roberts, for people all across America, black people, gay people, lesbians, everybody to see that this was discrimination one-on-one while this woman went to prison.
In each of these episodes, how willing were all sides of this case to talk? How willing were they to talk? How willing were the prosecutors, the defense counsels, and any one of the people involved? I'm talking about the people in the criminal justice system, the prosecutors, and so forth, or the defenders, were they willing to say, you know what, looking back at it now, we screwed up. We should not have done this. We should have, or whether the defense attorney saying, you know what, I should have fought harder for my client. I should have believed in this person and gone to whatever means necessary in the law to serve my client.
The defense lawyers were more prone to talk than the prosecutors and the police. The judges were prone to talk, the ones who had exonerated them based on clear convincing evidence. But the prosecutors, and many times when it was clear that these people were innocent and that it was proven they were innocent, they still offered technicalities and bureaucracy to further their incarceration for months, sometimes years, after their actual innocence had been established. They would try to argue other technical points where they still shouldn't get out of prison. So it was the judges, after seeing overwhelming, clear and convincing evidence, which is the high standard for a wrongfully convicted person to be exonerated. It's actual innocence based on clear and convincing evidence. And they had to prove this, Simon, in each one of these cases. I mean, can you imagine after the witness come forward and recant their version? They say that we lied. The prosecutor told us we had to lie, because if we didn't lie, we were going to go to prison. And you got that testimony out there, but the prosecutors still refused to acknowledge the actual innocence of this individual, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that there was a miscarriage of justice. They continue to say, well, we just want to check the box and make sure that we say we solved this crime. We don't care who it is, any black or brown face would do.
Evidence of Innocence is the new TV One series dealing with cases where people who have protested their innocence all along and were not listened to at the beginning, they finally do get their innocence. And it premieres on TV One Monday, June 4th at 10:10 Eastern Pacific Time. Benjamin Crump, the noted civil rights attorney, is now the host of the program. He's also one of the executive producers. And he joins us live this afternoon from Los Angeles. Air Nerve exclusive interview here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Glad you're with us. Got a few more minutes with the noted civil rights attorney. So give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Remember, if you came in late on today's episode, or you want to catch up on episodes you missed, we've had some very interesting people coming your way all month long, give us a check. go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our replay of our shows available to you 24/7. You can also go to iTunes.com, Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. Some of our recent episodes are on the Spreaker podcast radio app and also on iHeartRadio's podcast network. Just go to www.iHeartRadio.com, click Marvin Televised, put in the search bar, click in, and you are right there. Do you hope that out of this series that people who are in the predicaments of the folks, the people that you showcase, that there are more options that they have to get a fair trial or to make sure that whatever evidence that they have or the defense attorneys have that can clear them does get in that courtroom?
Yeah, that's exactly the goal and the aspiration of the show, Simon. That is to tell people that it could happen to you if you're, you know, if you are not careful. Anybody could get caught up in the system. By a large part, the majority of wrongfully convicted people are black men, but they are white men, white women, many people who are wrongfully convicted. And this is a show to say never, ever give up on your loved ones. Never give up on innocence, because innocence matters. It actually matters. And in America, we're the great beacon of hope and justice for the world to marvel. So we have to, more than anybody, understand that innocence matters. It was the great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes who said, "I rather 1,000 guilty men go free than one innocent man go to prison." Somehow we lost that virtue of the courts that was stated back in the late 1800s by Oliver Wendell Holmes. We have to get back to that. We have to find our moral compass, that it truly is about trying to find redeeming qualities in our brothers and sisters that make up society in America, and not try to only punish people and say you have nothing to offer to society, so we're going to lock you up like an animal for 20, 30 years. We have to do better as Americans. We have to do better as a society. And so I believe this show is a starting point that helps people out acknowledge that there are people who say, "I didn't do it." They didn't do it. And this is what we're fighting. One of your listeners, Simon, are going to be serving on a jury in the future. And I hope that they think back about this interview. I hope they tune in to TV1 on June 4th on Monday night at 10 o'clock. And when they're listening to the evidence being offered by the police and the prosecutor, they hold the police to their burden of proof and the fact that they make sure that that person, no matter whether they're black, white, Hispanic, gay, lesbian, transgender, it doesn't matter, that they get their constitutional rights. You know, I get so many calls on my Twitter, at Attorney Crump, where people are sharing injustices with me, where they say my child is innocent, my husband is innocent, my wife is innocent, but yet nobody listens to them. Nobody cares. Well, we as a society hopefully will care a little more after this serious evidence of innocence premieres, and you get to see the stories, I mean these emotional stories about how these families never gave up on their loved ones, and even though sometimes it took 3 decades, they were proven right and that they were innocent. And they have these T-shirts, and they give all wrongfully convicted people when they get out say, "I didn't do it." Hopefully, if you have a loved one and you're listening to this radio program, you won't give up on them, and one day your family member, your loved one, will wear that T-shirt that say, "I didn't do it."
Evidence of Innocence is TV1's new series and premieres Monday, June 4th, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. Check your local for where TV1 is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about this program and TV1's full schedule online, here's where you go, www.tv1.tv. That's www.tv1.tv. Evidence of Innocence, June 4th, 10 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. Benjamin Krause, it has been an honor to have you on this program. Congratulations for the work you do. Good luck with this series where you're hosting, executive producing, and let's hope that out of it we not only get a fuller, deeper, richer look in the justice process, but what we can do to make a difference with it.
Hey, thank you so much, Simon. And everybody in your audience, thank you all for acknowledging that innocence matters.
It certainly does. Thank you, Benjamin. All the greatest to you and your colleagues. Take care.
Okay. God bless you.
You're very welcome. Benjamin Krause, the noted civil rights attorney and the host executive producer of Evans & Vincent on TV One, coming June 4th, joining us live from Los Angeles. Before we go, time for Up as an update where we catch up on some of the guests and topics we've had in this program. On last Friday's episode, we introduced you to Jeff Stepanoff, the executive director of Georgia Film Academy, engaged in a number of activities to generate new TV talent in that state. Well, this past Monday, the Academy launched a collaboration with the state's Department of Education and other organizations to create a dramatic writing high school course. The focus, TV and digital content. The course will be adopted by high schools statewide and begin classes as early as August. And who knows, maybe the next great talent in television could come from that high school class that will start through the Georgia Film Academy and other statewide education institutions later this summer. And that will do it for this 90-day edition of Tomorrow Be Televised. Thank you to all of our guests. Thank you all of you for listening in. Remember, we are back on Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, and our guests will be, among others, the break with Michelle Wolf's executive producers, Dan Powell and Christine Nagel. And then next Tuesday, remember our special time, post-Memorial Day edition, 5 p.m. Eastern to Pacific, our lead guest, the executive producer and director of the New Stars miniseries, Wrong Man, award-winning filmmaker Joe Berlinger. Again, if you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episode missed, go to blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version in a variety of places, from iTunes to Apple TV's iTunes podcast app and the iHeartRadio podcast network. I'd love to hear what you thought about today's program. We had a lot of very sensitive, intimate subjects today. And what's your thoughts about not only those subjects, but where is TV at and where it's going? Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to include your name, where you're from. Remember, that's how you get involved in our classic trivia question of the week. And that's also how you get involved in our regular feature, Show to Know. Is there a TV show you like that doesn't get enough attention? Well, let me know. We'll give it the attention. If we do, you get the credit. simonapple04@yahoo.com. You also find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter. I do respond to all communication in 24 hours. Why? Because what you say matters. Always. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not only those of Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of Enterprise, Alan Levy, and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise is brought to you today by Audible.com, an Amazon company and proud development partner for the second year in a row of the annual New York Television Festival, Back in the Big Apple, this July. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For a free audiobook and 1 month trial, audibletrial.com/televise. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your Wednesday. We're back in less than 48 hours. At 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, Friday, right here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. So please join us then. Bring a friend, won't you? Have them listen too. I think they'll really enjoy it. And of course, whatever you're up to the rest of the day and tomorrow until we get together again, please make it safe and make it great. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.